This episode is brought to you by Doc Marty Mushrooms. Are you looking to boost your health and wellness? Well, we've got an incredible range of functional mushrooms for you created by Doc Marty. Whether you're looking to support your brain and nervous system or your immunity, sleep, gut health, and much more, go check out DocMarty.com. That's DocMarty.com. I've known Doc Marty for 30 years. And his absolute focus on getting these products to market has been inspirational, to say the least. That's Doc Marty Mushrooms, which focuses on the philosophy of prevention rather than cure, emphasizing the importance of incorporating these supplements into daily health routines to maintain and enhance well-being. So head to DocMarty.com and use the code EXPANSIVE20 for 20% off your first order. That's DocMarty.com, EXPANSIVE20.
Hi and welcome to the Expansive Podcast. My name is Eric Kruger. I'm a keynote speaker and author. We have been recording the Expansive Podcast for the past 4, maybe 5 years. We are 220 episodes deep. We have been the best career and entrepreneurship podcasts of 2023. We are now nominated for a new award, the Podcast of the Year. And through this entire journey, I've been joined by my ever elegant co-host, co-pilot, Mr. John Sonne, who is also an author, keynote speaker, futurist, who's just come back from, well, not come back, you are still in the States, but you've just had an incredible experience at the National Speakers Association, which we'll chat about just now. But dude, how's things going?
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you. Good to be in the States again. Always interesting to be here. I often remark to everybody I speak to here how we were outside the bubble. We were watching the Hollywood machine build its propaganda for us. And we were all so like enthralled with the American dream. And it's all we ever saw and all we ever like experienced. And coming here and seeing the bubble from the inside is very interesting because it's kind of familiar in a way, which is so weird. It's like familiar, but you've never been here. I've also hired a car, so I'm driving on the other side of the road, which is also kind of a little bit weird. It's great. I love it. I've just come back from Denver. I'm in Austin at the moment. I'm driving down to Dallas in the next couple of days. So yeah, just enjoying this part of the States, and it's unbelievably hot. My God, I was escaping Dubai, and it's as hot as Dubai. It is crazy hot.
Listen, it's pretty interesting how things get normalized over time, And I guess this is true for us through our entire lives. You know, even like if you think of like, you earn a paycheck when you come out of, school or varsity, whatever it may be. And then eventually like what you earned in a month becomes what you earn in a day, becomes what you earn in an hour. And like, you know, like it just normalizes over time. And I think it's the same with traveling. And I remember one of my first experience of America was, I think I must have been 7 years old or 8 years old. And we had a very wealthy uncle and he traveled to the States and he came back with like a whole bunch of gifts for his daughters. And I don't remember that. I don't think I got anything, but they got all these amazing gifts. And the one gift they got were shoes where the soles would light up. And I was like, wow, like that is so cool. Like America must be like the most incredible thing in the world. And that was my first experience and exposure of it feels so advanced and so like ahead and so in the future, like they have these cool shoes that are flashing and like we just have normal souls here in South Africa.
Yeah, I think America was that, you know? I think America was that. It was leading the way in many ways. It does still lead the world in many ways. Yeah. There's pockets of America that are exceptionally far ahead, but I have been spoiled by Dubai. And living in Dubai, you just nothing touches the architecture, the just everything. It just nothing touches it. So when you go to Singapore and Dubai, you got a resonance of a very futuristic city. But I think what Dubai and Singapore have in common and what it differentiates them out of America, it's that it's a city state. There's like 3 million people there. And it's got a much bigger brand than America does. So whenever I tell people in America that I'm from Dubai, everybody's got the exact same response. Ooh, Dubai. Like, it's got such a good PR marketing machine that people are enthralled with it. And I have to keep reminding them, do you know how big Dubai is? It's like 3 million people. It's 45 minutes from one side to the other. It's just that a marketing PR machine, like, second to none. And so I suppose in America, you have the same pockets of excellence, and they're just pockets. But America is a big country and very, very divided at the moment, but with its political scenario. But it looks like the Democrats are pulling ahead at the moment. And it looks like there's a new wave of, I suppose, optimism in the country in some ways. So, yeah, it's great to be here. I really enjoyed National Speakers Association. Should we get into that a little bit and talk about that?
Yeah, listen, I mean that's you know, that's a huge deal, because the national, for those that don't know, you know, when you are in the professional speaking world, there are a few bodies, like, it's not really a governed thing, but there are a few different bodies that bring speakers together. We have a local one in South Africa, which is an extension of the National Speakers Association. It's called the Professional Speakers Association of South Africa. And we are either, like, neither of us are actually part of it for some very specific reasons, but the National Speakers Association—that's I mean, that's just
that's a whole podcast.
That's a
on
whole
its
podcast
own.
On its own. Maybe there's some triggers to unpack. But the National Speakers Association is just on a totally different level. You know, I guess, you know, it operates in the States, so you can expect the kind of scale that comes with that, and it is the biggest speakers association in the country. And so, I mean, you know, you were recently asked to go and close this association, like their big like conference that they had. And it's a huge deal. So I want to make a big deal of it as well. And I want us to make sure that we appreciate the effort of a guy that comes from the East Rand that ends up in the States closing out the conference for one of the biggest speakers association in the world. Well done, brother.
Thank you so much. You know, while you're saying it, it's like, I guess I'm also like rethinking how big it is. Like, I got like slight goosebumps thinking about it. I mean, look, it's the pinnacle of the speaking world in many ways. And the speakers in between, like in the conference, were incredible. Like, you had this guy who was like Tony Robbins' right-hand man. And then you had this other guy who's worked with like all sorts of these NBA stars, and like really like established, well-known speakers in America were in the middle. So to have the honor of closing is it's a huge thing, because most speakers are looking up to those speakers in the middle. And so it's almost like a very weird, surreal experience, because, like, I don't know, I can't even explain it, because I wasn't even expecting to be part of it. I had no idea the organizers were following me on social media. I had no idea how big it was when I was invited. When I was invited, I thought, okay, yeah, it sounds cool. And then the more I started looking into it, the more I started researching, I was like, wow, what? Jeez, I have no idea how big and established this is. So, I mean, I think it's going for like 30, 40 years. The American speaking industry is worth $4 billion. $4 billion. It is a massive, massive industry. And, you know, they were speaking to me about certain people that they book. They've just confirmed Simon Sinek, $180,000. They had Reese Witherspoon come and do a just to be seen somewhere, $400,000. I mean, it's just the numbers are...
No, it's a different world altogether to operate in.
It's a different world.
Definitely.
So... But also what I was so grateful for is that I was with my agent, Gail from GDA Speakers, and she was with me the whole conference, and she was so proud to have me there. And she's the one who just booked Simon Sinek. And so there's this incredible like momentum that's building, and I can feel that it's building. I have the right people backing me in America and right people like putting me forward for what's next. And so I haven't arrived. And I think I was telling you this in the conversation. I sent you a voice note from the airport. I was like, I haven't arrived as somebody desperate to get into the industry. I've actually arrived with somebody with some gravitas. And it's just been an incredible experience. The audience was fantastic. I had some incredible feedback. And so, yeah, I just feel very, I feel very proud that.
Yeah, and you should.
I've come here. Thank you. And I've done well and it's landed. And it's a, just another step to get you more international work, Eric. I mean, that's the whole point
look,
of this.
Whenever you do anything, I always just tell you how happy I am for us, you know? So, like, you get a place in Dubai, I'm happy for us. Like, I'm excited for our new place, you know? It's like.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that's great. And I'm very happy to open up doors. And there was Joey Evans there as well from Kempton Park. For people who are not from South Africa, in Johannesburg, you have these areas. You have the north of Joburg where all the rich people live. And then you have the south of Joburg where all the sort of fighters live. And then you have the east of Joburg, which is like the nobodies of the world boots, live. Yeah. It's like, I don't know. It's a nonchalance thing. And we all come from the East Rand. So does Charlize Theron. And we all somehow come from the East Rand.
It's so funny.
And it's a funny thing because only if you're from Johannesburg do you understand the specificity of the personality of the very middle class to lower class like areas in the East Rand. And so Joey was there from Kempton Park and I was there from Edenvale, both of us from the East Rand. And we were just laughing at the fact that we're all the way here in America doing what we're doing all the way from this little dreamy little town. And actually the way I opened up the conference was welcome to my dream. And explained where I was from and what I was doing here and how the invite had come about. And just incredible to have experienced that. And I'm looking forward to what it's going to bring.
Yeah, I love that. And I think also that, I think that's a big part of your success is that you've always had a very high level of vulnerability, you know, which I think is often very missing in the circles that we operate in. It's very, very focused on the work that must be done on the tangibles, the metrics, etc. And I think you've always come in with more of a vulnerability angle. And so even opening up, because, you know, you would think that you get onto that kind of stage and there's a certain posture to have because, like, oh, I'm here and you sitting in the audience listening to me here. Whereas the way that you open it up is to talk about this journey that you've been on. And what it means for you to be on that stage. And I think that's a big part of your success.
Yeah, you're right. Again, thank you. Again, I haven't even thought of that, but thank you for putting words to that, you know. And one of the slides that I use that has actually been shared the most is everybody thinks that being on stage is, and under the bright lights is what makes you successful, but the bright lights only show up the work that you've done in the dark. And it's really about that work that you've done in the dark that allows you to feel the value and the worth to experience something like that. So, you know, there's a lot of behind the scenes work. And you know, I mean, we've done so many pods on the meditation and the healings and all those sort of things. So that is such a big part of it that I think most people don't think about or engage with as much as they would do. And again, I made a video just this morning about some people commenting on a video I made about AI and its IQ and what's going to happen to the IQ of AI. So just a recap was AI is at 155 right now, doubles every 5.5 months. By the end of this year, it'll be at 310, middle of next year, 620. By the end of next year, 1,250, whatever it may be. And, you know, Einstein's at 155. I mean, Elon Musk is at 155. Einstein is at 162. And these people are changing the world at a tenth of the IQ of what AI is going to have. So I've been having these people come at me on social, on TikTok and Instagram, Facebook, saying to me that you can't measure IQ like that. And what you should be doing is da-da-da-da, going through a whole bunch of theoreticals. And my response to them was very clear. It's like Einstein said it best. He said, a clever person needs to solve a problem. A wise person avoids it. And what happens is when you're too caught up in the head, what you have to keep doing is trying to analyze, be analytical, and find some solution to the way, whether it was correctly calculated or not. And in the whole time, what you're doing there is missing the whole point of the video, missing the whole point of the lesson. And the whole point is you can't compete IQ to IQ, however you want to measure it. And the example I used is that we still utilize horsepower when we think about Ferraris and our engines. Does it make any sense to measure anything with horsepower attached to it in this day and age? Of course not. It is zero relevance to what a Ferrari, 600 horsepower. What, you got 600 horses in there? How do you measure that? So it's the same thing, is that when you are not vulnerable, when you are too caught up and too heady and too intelligent for your own good, you have to keep solving problems that you keep creating to solve to add value to the world and give yourself some level of worth, rather than being vulnerable to the point of, let me explore something new. Let me be more adaptable. And I almost think that when your IQ is too high, you are less adaptable to actually being vulnerable, to actually start to connect with an audience and to actually start to exploring things you don't quite understand. So I think it's all mixed up in there around releasing old to engage with new, all through the process of vulnerability.
Two things, and then I think we can get into the pod, is that I do think very often high IQ means that you're probably sacrificing some EQ points somewhere. And Elon Musk is actually a good example. I don't think he connects well with people at all. I think he's quite adaptable, and he's obviously good at innovating and seeing different angles. But you sacrifice EQ, and maybe that's kind of the law of life, is that, you know, you'll excel in certain things at the cost of other things. And we need people like him who are high IQ to create space for people with high EQ to thrive in as well.
You're so right. I always complain that I'm not part of Mensa and I'm jealous of them because I didn't have the IQ. I mean, so you're right. I've got a high EQ, yeah, but I don't have the IQ.
And we need both. I did fail school. And like, you know, both will thrive in the future in different kind of ways. And that's also okay. But the second thing is, I think we are maybe overdue for a bit of a pod on maybe like a new approach to success, because I do think when I look at the way that you've approached it over the years, and we've done a few episodes like this over time, I think you've arrived in a way that you've always wanted to arrive. You know, we're like, and we've had these conversations so many times between the two of us as well, is about the patience, is about the trusting of the process, is about giving it space and about knowing your value as well. And I think there's been a lot of internal work that has happened. And maybe it's good to just recap that, you know, because we say we've spoken about it so much, but also we've spoken about it a year ago maybe. And we've had so many new listeners join us as well. And even recently, I've been on this journey again where I've seen, it's like a very clear message that the universe is sending to me about worth at the moment, where probably in the last 3 weeks, I've had to turn down three different engagements. And it was all around, like, will you stand up for what you believe your worth is in the marketplace and how you do things? And you even sent me a screenshot as well of something similar that you had to do with clients from yours, you know? And so it's very interesting because you have to do a lot of that sort of, like, internal recalibration. But what it allows you to do is that when you achieve that success or when you get into that next level, you do so with a sense of integrity with yourself instead of like just chasing it. Like you step into it and you step into it as worthy because you knew that worth was there to start with. So maybe it's time for us to revisit that as well.
Very good. I think we should. You remember we did that the law of intention, law of action, the law of allowance.
And it was a very good episode. People loved it.
Yeah. Mm. Those three are so important. We stop law of allowance. And then the fourth would be to always think you're incredible. And if you think of the word incredible, it means you're internally credible. And if you think you're incredible, you're internally credible, then you project that credibility onto the world and then it reflects back to you. So if you take a gig that you think is too cheap or somebody speaks to you in a way you don't like and you put up with it, then that becomes the standard. And you're not really thinking you're internally credible. So yes, it's such a fine-tuning process of that internal dialogue that is so like so important. And because it's not out in the physical world and it's just in our own heads, we don't give it enough credence. And so, yeah, we need to visit it.
But it's such small things, right? And it's such small things. And I remember you coming back from that one, I don't know if it was like what sort of journey you went on, but you came back and you said, I had the realization that I always say I want to be successful, but I already am successful. And so
it was Dr. Joe.
Yeah. So it's those small little changes that we make that ultimately, you know,
they are so important. It's unbelievable. I mean, that change was, it happened 2 years ago. And I remember saying to myself, I'm not successful enough. And I shifted that to, I'm already successful.
That was it, yes.
And you know what happened is I opened my eyes at a walking meditation, because every morning in Cancun, you do a walking meditation at Dr. Joe Dispenza. And you open your, so you imagine who you want to be and where you want to be. And then you walk as that person so that you embody it in your cellular structure. It's an incredibly powerful process. But I opened my eyes. I was in a 5-star resort with beautiful people around me at sunrise in the most brilliant blue ocean with white beaches. And then Dr. Joe walks right past me while I open my eyes. And I started crying. And I started realizing I am living in my future. This is the future me that I'd always been thinking about. And at that moment, I realized I was successful. What was going to be the further piece of success? But there, like, that was the cap. That was the ceiling. And it was such a great realization. And I wish everybody to have it, you know?
Yeah, so let's do a recap episode of all those moments, I think it's at some point in the future, and talk about the process of trust, patience, worth, and all of that in the role
you've
of
also,
success.
Yeah, but you've also had a huge awakening to that.
I mean,
know?
I've been
with
going through
work,
a lot.
You've
for
had
sure.
a massive, yeah.
No, I've had some big shifts in the past year. So yeah, I think let's do a recap.
Yeah.
But for now, let's chat to Robin. Do you want to just tell us who Robin is?
Because there's
like woman on our
call
here today. Let me tell us who she is.
Is she supposed to be here?
So first of all, we want to we introduced Robin a few sessions ago, explaining that we've brought on a new producer, and Robin has been excellent, so enthusiastic, so passionate about the podcast world, and now she's even got a client in New York. So she's really branching out and has got like these international clients. So Robin is our producer, and she is going to be joining us today to create a different type of the pod, do a couple Q&As with Eric and I, and just add a female's voice, which I also think is incredibly important. I know we've had messages from some of our female listeners asking us for more female guests and some more female energy. And look, we are 100% for that, you know? I mean, obviously, the more girls around, the happier we're going to be. I mean, that just goes without a question. But beside that is, we have also been very specific about bringing on a female producer because we want to have that female touch. And so it's with great pleasure that we have Robin on for the first time speaking on the pod. So welcome, Robin.
Thank
How are you?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited. This is my first. I've been behind the behind the camera. This is my first time in front of the camera on a podcast. So I'm really, I'm excited. And so let's jump in. So I'm going to start with John. I have a question for John, question for Eric, and then kind of joint questions at the end to kind of round us out. So John, in our last episode with Ellie and Rowan, you were quite moved by their concept of seeing your business, seeing businesses as their own sentient being, and looking at your past life of owning restaurants through that lens. I find your professional trajectory from owning restaurants to where you are now so fascinating. And I know a lot of our new listeners also find it incredibly fascinating. And it's such a key part of your story, especially the fact that it ended in bankruptcy. Well, ended, but also just started your new journey. I'd love it if you could start by kind of like walking us through how it all started, when the restaurant was just a twinkle in your eye, and what it was like, what happened to lead you to bankruptcy, and then ultimately how that experience shaped your life now, and if there were any like pivotal moments, as you were kind of saying in your last conversation, where it was like, what is going on with life? What am I doing to, okay, I can now shift this and go towards a different future. But yeah, take us back to the beginning when the restaurant was just a twinkle in your eye, young John Sarnay in Joburg in the early 2000s, 90s.
Bodybuilder John Sarnay, by the way.
Oh my God, I didn't even know about the bodybuilding stuff. Okay, so yeah, let's start from there. So,
great. Thank you so much. It was a great question. You know, I come from a single mom family, so we were always financially challenged. And the quickest way for me to start making money was waitering. So I was a waiter from very young, and I just understood the world of waitering. I was very good at it. I was good. I'm personable, so I can chat to anybody and have fun doing it. And also, I won Junior Mr. South Africa when I was 19, took steroids, and then two of my friends died from steroid overdose. And I was like, okay, I'm out. So I got out of the sort of bodybuilding world because it really is the most, probably the most unhealthy sport in the world. And I was a barman in London. I was, again, in hospitality. And when I came back to South Africa, I went on holiday in 1999 to Cape Town, and I sat inside the very first Premier in Green Market Square in Cape Town, which back then was called the Nino's, but it just started to shift towards a Premier. And I sat in that restaurant, I thought to myself, this is going to be an amazing brand. I was so impressed by what they were doing that the minute I got home, I emailed them and said to them, I'd love to be involved with their brand. And we started chatting, and I pretended that I had a lot of money because I wanted to buy a store, but I actually didn't have all that money. I had maybe a quarter of that money. Back then it was 1.6 million rand for a store. I had like a few hundred thousand rand. That I'd come back from with London. And so we started chatting and eventually I flew down to Cape Town to meet with them, and we got along, and I could afford to buy a half of the restaurant in Constantia, the first sort of franchised store that they did. And then that was when I was 24 years old. And I remember my waiters were older than me, and I remember being worried that my guests would think that I was a waiter or a manager. So I would arrive at the table, say, hi, my name's John, owner of the restaurant. Shame. Shame. And I say shame because I just want to hug him, man. You know, it was just insecurity and needed acknowledgement. So either way, I worked my butt off and the shop did really well. And then I went on to own six of them, you know, and so I just kept buying them and selling them and buying them and selling them and the brand. But you could do no wrong with Premier Piatti from 2000 to 2008. I mean, anybody would hear that you were opening one and there would be a queue already. So it was a very amazing time, and it really developed so much courage in me. At one stage, I had hundreds of staff members. I had rents, and I can't even believe I did that. At like 26, 27 years old, I had three restaurants at the same time. I had partners, and it was just so much, you know. But then what happens is when you're that age, you think you become bulletproof. And so, and I comment that you have high levels of testosterone and high levels of money are a very bad mix. And I thought I could do no wrong, you know what I mean? So I invested in clothing stores. I invested in vending machines. I was just like, I can do everything. I'm going to have three restaurants and these other four businesses and houses and cars, and just piled it on. And then one of the restaurants started faltering. And I thought to myself, what I would do is I would prop it up until I could sell it and then carry on with the rest of my life, you know? But I don't know, 12 months later, I turned around. It was losing more money than ever before. I started running out of cash. And about 18 months in, I realized I had to do something drastic because I couldn't keep going. You know, I didn't have the cash flow. My business wasn't picking up. I didn't know how to get out of it. And I had to declare bankruptcy. Otherwise, I didn't know what else to do. I was stuck. So it was a very, very tough 6 months. I didn't sleep for 6 months. And the first night that I actually slept well was when I decided I was going to declare bankruptcy on the Friday morning. It was Thursday night. It was the first night that I'd slept well in months. And yeah, I woke up and called the sequestration lawyer and handed the keys over. Head office of Premier wanted to kill me. I was so embarrassed. I had to get out of my house. I didn't have a car. It was just a very, very tumultuous, horrible, horrible time. And it took me years to recover, years. But what it's done for me now, it's firstly, what it's done is change my relationship with money, because all I was doing then was extracting all those businesses for as much money as I could get. Two, everybody with a daddy issue is desperate for acknowledgement. I had daddy issues, and everybody at Premier had daddy issues. From the CEO, everybody had daddy issues. Everybody had abusive dads. And in that abusive dad world, everybody's desperate for acknowledgement. And when you're desperate something, you attract abuse. Think about anybody who's desperate for anything. You attract abuse, because any form of desperation brings about the other side of it. And so daddy issues that I had to heal, money issues that I had to heal. And the worst part was that I worked so hard for 10 years and left minus 8 million rand, which is such a hard pill to swallow. But it put me into the self-development world. I started to dive deep into figuring out what had happened to me. And today I have a lot more empathy for people that are working like that and leadership in many ways as well. So great question. Thank you.
Wow. That is so, so interesting. Do you have like that one moment where you were like after the self-development, after like diving into it, you were like, I actually could make a career out of this. Like I'm actually going to pursue a speaking career.
You know what's so funny? My friends remember very well, Sean McKenna, especially me telling him I want to be a speaker. And I can't remember saying this to him, but I said it to him a few times that I think I can be a speaker. I'm going to be a speaker. So even in the restaurant times, I had an inclination that I wanted to do something like that. And I remember that once I'd gone bankrupt, what I did was I had a little bit of money. I bought two big whiteboards and I put them into my friend's second bedroom that I was living at because I couldn't live anywhere else. And they sat blank because I wanted to do a workshop and a brainstorm of what I was going to speak about, but I couldn't think of anything. And I actually give those boards away because I couldn't think of anything. And only years later did the actual message of what I want to say and how I need to say it started to become, you know, come into fruition. So it took years, but I kind of knew from a young age. And my granddad was a poet. And I used to listen to my granddad recite poetry and people used to come and listen to him recite poetry. So I think it's kind of in my lineage in a way, you know, being a storyteller.
Wow, yeah. I love that.
I remember the very first time I saw a John Sonne video. And I didn't know who you were at the time. I just remember seeing you had a thick beard, like big, big beard, big glasses. And it's like, this dude looks, he has an interesting look. And then, like, I didn't really listen to the video. And then
you still don't listen to my videos.
I listen to your videos. I listen to your videos now. I do.
In the recording.
But then, I do remember the big beard. Maybe you need to bring that back.
Yeah, bring back the beard.
Bro, I've seen that video. And that video, I had no idea how far or how close the phone must be to me. I think I had it up my nostril. The phone was right up my nostril. You could see every detail of my nose hairs. So yes, I've learned a lot from that.
Yeah, that is so interesting. Thank you so much for sharing that. Like,
okay, pleasure.
So Eric, now on to you. A few weeks ago on the podcast, we were talking about burnout and you were saying how you felt a real call to get into nature, turn off your phone, just chill before you like really, really needed it. And one thing you talk about a lot is pushing yourself out of your comfort zone and being uncomfortable with uncertainty. Which I think means like hustling, taking risks, being bold. But it's ironic that actually relaxing and taking a step back can be the hardest thing to do for people and actually taking the time away from work. As someone who constantly pushes for excellence and just to be your best, how do you strike that balance between ambition and taking the time to simply be, to fill up your cup and be more passive rather than actively pursuing the success?
Sure. That's something that I've had to work on for a very, very long time. Because when I did my Enneagram, I realized that I was an Enneagram number 3. So the Enneagram 3 is the competitive achiever. And if you're a competitive achiever, all you want to do is achieve. And you just want to do and go and get more results and do more things. And once you've done more things, you want to do more things than that. And I think it's a trap that we get lulled into so easily. I even saw I think it was Simone Biles actually posted this after she won some of her golds with this Olympics now, where she said, like, everyone is already asking the Olympic athletes that have won gold, like, what's next? And she's like, can you just slow down? Can we just enjoy the fact that we've worked for 4 years to achieve this amazing feat that we've just done? Can we just, like, enjoy that for a moment? And so I think that's become, you know, I think there are a few layers to this. The first is that personally, I've worked hard to enjoy the process a bit more and not to only focus on what comes out of it. And I think a lot of the things that we listen to, you know, the teachers that we listen to, a lot of them will say that you need to do the work and let go of the outcome. And in that letting go, there's actually quite a bit of peace and sort of freedom that comes with it. And so all of a sudden, what you find is that just during your day-to-day, just during your usual hustle or grind, you find that there's actually some peace in it when you don't think of it as a hustle or grind. When you think of it as just doing the work that you enjoy doing and the work that you love, and you surrender the outcome to whatever it may be. And so just in that, there's an easing that starts to occur, a relaxation that starts to occur that feels really good. But then on top of that, I do think that it's still important for us to be a lot more intentional as well with our time. I was working with a team at an offsite this past weekend. And I see this with every team. I see this with every leader. I guess we can say we see this in large organizations, is that we are also stuck in reactivity, that we make no time for just being with ourselves, sitting with ourselves, and creating a bit of thinking time. And what this results in is that we are just operating in default mode. We aren't proactively shaping our decisions and our actions. We are just reacting to what the world puts in front of us. And so when I was working with this team over the weekend, one of the guys said, you know, I make sure that every day I book out an hour in my day just for thinking time, just to slow down and consciously think about the challenges that I have. And you can see that the way he shows up is a lot more intentional and consciously shaped versus people who are just reacting. And one of the things that then came out of the offsite was, and it was so funny because when I take people through brainstorming at an offsite, what we do is we generate lots of ideas. And if I say lots of ideas, you know, each person generates 5 to 10 ideas. You pair up, you create 5 or 10 more ideas. And so you might sit with like 80 ideas that have been generated as a group. And then you go through this generation and then curation process. And one of the top 3 things that came out for this team was to have more time for myself. And so we all have this need to spend more time. We realize the importance of it, but yet we get dragged into the reactivity of the world. And if we can just schedule some time to slow down, to really think about how we are approaching the challenges and the opportunities in our lives, we get to be much more conscious creators. And I think we are more satisfied with the results that we get at the end as well. So of course, you need to also build in holidays and intentional time off. And like this weekend, I'm going away with Danica and the pups, and I can't wait to do that. But I don't think it's just about those big moments away. I really think it's more about the stance that you take towards the work that you do. So the everyday work and like releasing that outcome, and then consciously spending some time with yourself, especially because often that might feel very uncomfortable, but you'll be surprised what happens when you can start doing that. When I was driving back from the offsite, for 2 hours, I just drove in silence. I don't know if you've seen, but there's this big trend called like raw dogging.
Raw dogging flights, it? Yeah. Right. Men are so crazy.
So, So if you are raw dogging a flight, it means that you just stare at the screen in front of you. You're not allowed to listen to music or watch any sort of like videos or play any games. You just have to sit there and just look ahead of you. So I was raw dogging my trip back to the airport. And it was great because I was just thinking about what's currently happening in the business and what I want to do. And the clarity that you can get from a little bit of time of doing that is incredible. So, in short, I think that's my answer.
I'd like to just add to that.
Please.
Sorry, I just want to add to that and say that when you build a practice of meditation into your daily routine, you quite naturally move towards those spaces of stillness quite easily. And we don't realize that the sort of high beta brainwave addiction doesn't allow for that space. And you don't even have to start to put it in your calendar. When you start to develop that routine of meditation, it becomes part and parcel of who you are. So that's why that practice is so important. So you can bring that stillness and clarity and patience into listening just listening a little bit more. So yeah, and I've seen a massive shift in Eric from 3 years ago to sort of like a very impatient person to much more calm, and also reminding me to be calm sometimes on WhatsApp, which is like, what? Where's Eric? The hell? But yeah, so well done, Eric.
Yeah, and
thanks, bro.
Done the work. I mean, you guys, yeah. Even I find it such a privilege to be able to sit in the dark behind while you guys record, because like, obviously the listeners of the podcast will also relate. You guys have so many pearls of wisdom. And even for me, like, I've really tried to incorporate more like play and creativity time and like calm time, not just like scrolling on my phone and getting into that brainwave. And I've really like been putting it into practice for the past like month. And I've really, really like felt a difference. So yeah, that's been really, really cool for me. And this actually
brings
up, and also plus Doc Marty Lion's Mane Mushrooms. Thank you so much. it's just the whole thing. But this is actually great, because this brings me on to kind of a fun joint question for you guys. So on this podcast, we talk a lot about embracing change and the future. And you guys have both seen some wild shifts in the world of wellness, especially with the rise of psychedelics and experimental therapies like that, ketamine, MDMA, ayahuasca, psilocybin, plus the whole spectrum of like sound baths and what John sometimes calls woo-woo hippie stuff, ironically. and I'm curious about your guys' experience with that shift from when you were younger and kind of the narrative you received on these kind of different, well, I mean, they weren't called wellness practices then, it was just drugs. So in like the 70s, 80s in South Africa around psychedelics, and now that the therapies are kind of inching their way into mainstream wellness, how has your perspective shifted? Do you maybe eventually see a world where ayahuasca journeys might be a corporate bonding retreat? So like, yeah, anything like that on how you guys have seen the kind of change from yourself?
Well, I'll start because I'm the oldest here. And I remember
most experience.
When I was...
When was the first time you heard about psychedelics or anything like that?
Yeah, look, I was 19 years old. And out of all my friends, I was keen to try it. So I tried my first drug when I was 19. Mom, I know you're listening to this. And I know you know this, Mom. I turned out okay, Mom. I turned out okay. Don't panic. So I never liked alcohol. I always found that it made me feel queasy and stupid. And actually, if you watch drunk people, when you're not drunk, they look retarded in many ways. So I never wanted to be that. And so I did try drugs. And I think subconsciously I was seeking this other alternate aspect that I could tap into. And I was seen in very bad light with the rest of my friends. The rest of my friends were worried, even though they were drinking a bottle of whiskey every weekend, they were worried about me doing the things that weren't accepted in sort of society. But I think that's what an early adopter and a futurist is somebody that is consistently looking for what's next and then trying out and trying to figure out how it fits into the way I want to incorporate my life. I think that we have to also realize that the structure that we live in, everything that keeps you dumb and numb is legal. So if you think about alcohol and pharmaceuticals and gluten and sugar, these things are all amazingly available to us everywhere, but keep us dumb in many, many ways. And everything that opens up your consciousness, from psychedelics to mushrooms to MDMA to all the ayahuasca, is all illegal. So you got to ask yourself, hang on a second, how does legality and illegality work? And why is there a control of anything that opens up your consciousness? And I am a rebel at heart. I was terrible at school. I don't like laws and rules because I think, except in Dubai, I'm by the rules in Dubai because I just love that country. I'm respectful of it. But I just think in general, even Dubai and even the UAE have bought into the Western ideals of somebody in a white jacket tells you to take 15 tablets, it's okay. And we've now realized that those pharmaceuticals are actually terrible for us in many ways. It creates addictions and our bodies can't heal from them. So I'm more excited than anything else because I've kind of been on this trip for a very long time. Excuse the pun.
Yeah.
For a very long time. I mean, I'm 50. So that means 30 years of experimenting with these things. And I think ultimately it's opened up my consciousness and allowed me to access a wisdom that's, we've all got the Romans called it the pocket of genii that lives on top of all of our heads. And our job really in life is to access this pocket of genii so that you can have access to the genius version of who you are. And I think all of these things have done that for me in many ways. So I'm more than excited that these things are becoming legalized and people experimenting with them and ultimately stopping to call them drugs and actually start to call them teacher plants and journeys to healing.
Yeah, I think I've seen a huge shift in the people that I deal with over the past couple of years. I think we are very far away from it being part of a exco offsite. I think that there may be a few excos where like they might be open enough to it, but for it to be a mainstream offsite, I think we're very, very far away from that. And I think the big thing is just the uncertainty about it, that you have a certain history, you know, that you have with these sort of interventions, purely from a, like, you know, you've read about it or you've seen about it or you've heard about it. And like, you've never experienced it, but you have the sort of perspective on it because this is what's been created for you over the however many years. And so to shift that perspective, I think, is really difficult. And so when I've had conversations with people around this, I don't find that the judgment is there. Like, I don't find anyone going, you want to go do a psilocybin journey, like, you know, you're going to hell. I'm not hearing that. What I'm hearing is, like, I don't want to lose control, or I'm so worried about what the outcome might be, or, I'm someone who, I'm very logical about things. I don't want to go and be illogical about it, or whatever it may be. But like, that's more, it's more a fear of the unknown than it is a judgment. That's what I see mostly around me. And I think that's also a bit of the journey that I've been on. I don't think I've ever really judged it. My only experience with these kind of medicines from before would have been people using it to party. And so it being used as something that helps you to unlock different ways of thinking or to help you heal trauma is a new way for me of understanding it as well. And I even saw a thing this morning where they were saying that they think MDMA might be one of the best things that potentially at some point might help to treat PTSD. And it was a Tim Ferriss post that came out. So I think that, you know, ultimately, and this is something that I've learned from John as well, is that these are all kind of things that you have to be called to, that you have to, the time will be right for you to go and figure it out for yourself and see if it's a time for you to explore what it might or could do for you. And I think often when we come across something that is exciting for us and that we feel have had a tremendous benefit to us, we want everyone to experience it. But it's not that kind of thing. Like, they need to come to it when they come to it. And as with anything, this is like, I've been working on a bit of a adaptability framework. And the first part of that framework is we have to cultivate a state of receptiveness. You can't change if it doesn't start with having openness. And so as with anything, when we move into the uncertain and when we are trying to make certain changes, just start with a state of receptiveness, meaning non-judgment, meaning I'll be curious about it and see. And then over time, you know, like, figure it out. But don't just shut it down because of historical perspectives or because of certain biases you might have. Adaptability, changing behavior, trying new things starts the moment you are presented with new information. And so just stay in the flow of change. Just stay in that openness all the time.
I love that, stay in the flow.
Very good. That's very wise of you, Eric. I like that. Yeah, very good. Remember, it was Elizabeth Gilbert who said, "Oh, darling, you never had control. You just had anxiousness." And so what most people say, like, "I don't want to lose control." I'm like, you never have control. You just have familiarity of thinking. And you're worried that if I let go of this familiarity of thinking, what else could be on the other side? Not realizing that your better version is on the other side. You're actually very low. I was actually telling the audience at NSA, we think as humans, we've peaked in our intelligence. And we're fearful of expressing and engaging with new types of intelligence. How arrogant, how deeply ignorant and arrogant of us to think, oh no, I've got control. I don't want to engage with anything new. I'm like, oh, please. People like that bore me.
Wow, guys.
No offense.
That was so amazing. Thank you so much for answering my questions. I have a couple more, but we can get to them another time. I just thought it would be funny to end with kind of like just a quick, interesting question for both of you guys surrounding the Olympics, and then we can wrap it up. So guys, if you had all the resources in the world and could quit your jobs for the next 4 years and train, money's no object, what sport would you do for the next Olympics?
Is talent an object? Like, does it have to be something that we have some talent in at all? Or can we buy talent?
It has to be something that you would be able to do in 4 years with all the training in the world.
Listen,
I'd love to run 100 meters, but that's just never happening.
I'll answer that straight away. At the offsite, I was, they had some guns there, and like, I've never shot a rifle before, but I'm a natural. So like, give me a gun. Let me go shoot stuff. You saw that guy, he's like James Bond, you know, like he was that meme went around with him and he's like,
yeah, the
so
guy
casual.
With the one hand.
That's me at the next Olympics if money
the
is no
guy.
Issue.
Eric, you know, you can take a boy out of the East from Springs, but you can't take Springs out of the boy, eh? Give me a gun, but give me a rifle. Not even a gun, a rifle. Did you also have a two-tone top on? Did you have that tan top on when you were shooting it, bro?
Checkered shirt all the way.
Checkered shirt. Now, I think the most exciting race at the Olympics is the 4x400 meter. And I used to do athletics, and the 400 meter race is by far the hardest race because you have to sprint the whole way. You can't not sprint. With the 800, you got two gears. You got the first four and then the next. With the 400, it is flat out from the beginning.
No, but listen.
And so when I watch that.
But the question is, what will you do at the Olympics?
Yeah, I want to be part of the 4x4 relay.
But we said,
so
we said reasonable as
meters.
Well. We said reasonable. Like you have to have the talent as a starting point.
Are you joking, but? Are you kidding me, bro? Are you kidding?
Hammer throw, maybe?
I used to be a sprinter. I was right wing at rugby. No. I can definitely do that. I used to be a runner.
Yeah.
Don't forget who's done the Ironman here. Not you, bro. Okay, me. Not you.
So maybe you should have gone with triathlon. Maybe that would have been a better answer than sprinting for 400 meters when you're 50 years old.
No. What I've realized is that I'm super shit at Ironman. So I'll just stick to the sprinting.
Perfect.
Cool, Robs. Thank you so much for joining us for the pod today. It was great having your energy with us. Thank you for the questions. I think we'll do another one like this at some point in the future. And then to everyone listening, thank you so much for joining us as well. As always, we really appreciate your time. We know that you have many other podcasts to choose from as well. You have millions of podcasts to choose from, and you've decided to spend your time with us. And so for that, we are deeply appreciative. Just remember as well that you are listening to a podcast that has been nominated for Podcast of the Year by the African Podcast and Voice Awards. And well, actually voting, by the time you listen to this, I think voting would have closed. So let me rather use this opportunity to say thank you for everyone who has voted for the pod. We've been making quite a bit of a push of it on social media. So you would have seen lots of that coming out now that period is kind of done. Voting is closed on the 10th of August. You'll see less of that, less of a barrage of vote for us posts. But thank you. Thank you for voting for us. We do this for you. We have lots of interesting plans ahead of us for the pod, all for you, because we want to find ways to do this in a better way that adds even more value. So that's it from me. Thank you so much for joining, and we will see you again next week. Ciao.
Ciao.